CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Professor Nicholas Thomas. His new book is Voyagers, The Settlement of the Pacific. He's a professor of historical anthropology at the University of Cambridge, and that's what we're doing here, history, but near history. The mystery of Oceania begins with Captain Cook's first, second, and third voyage. Present mysteries to be solved. Professor, who was Captain Cook? Why he was there? Why was he in the Society Islands in 1768? What was his mission?
So Cook was a naval man, but he was above all an exceptionally accomplished surveyor. And that's why the Royal Society and the Admiralty selected him in the 1760s to lead an expedition. The ship was the Endeavour. They went to Tahiti, and the core purpose, certainly the ostensible purpose, was the observation of the transit of Venus. And that observation, that astronomical observation, was scientifically important. It was part of a coordinated set of observations, and the Royal Society and colleagues internationally hoped to be able to measure the distance between the Earth and the Sun. But Cook was also exploring the South Pacific because the British, among other European nations, were very interested to try and establish whether there was a great southern continent. They thought that a great southern continent might be a previously unknown land like China or India that could be a key trading partner, a huge source of wealth. So the expeditions were about knowledge and geographic discovery, but they were certainly also about empire and the scope for trade and colonization.
On board was Joseph Banks. Who was he, and what does he leave us to know about this first voyage?
Well, Banks was very important to this voyage because it was really one of the first that was scientifically really ambitious. The British Navy had sent out exploratory voyages before. They were typically concerned to map coastlines and territories, but Banks was a natural historian who had a much wider range of interests in botany, animals, people, resources. He was also very wealthy individually, so that even though he was partly funded by the Royal Society, the scientific society of the time, he also used a lot of his own money to pay for a team of assistants, botanists, artists, others. This was really one of the first expeditions that took a scientific team, a research group, a set of people capable of making a very wide range of observations. And Banks was absolutely committed to making the most of the opportunity.
There are many details here to the first, second, and third voyage of Captain Cook, but the one I'm going to focus on, because we're talking about voyages, is the observation of the craft that the Society Island and then the other islanders demonstrated to Endeavour on the first voyage and then the second and third voyage. They saw the craft, but they'd heard of them before from William Dampier, a pirate in the late 17th century. And also, you point to a Dutch warship that came across a large craft that it fired on in the early 17th century. What did Cook make? What did the navigator on board Endeavour and Resolution make of the island crafts?
Cook and other European mariners were really very interested in islanders' canoes, because, of course, being sailors themselves, they were interested in the technical capacities of boats. They were interested in how well they sailed, how fast they could sail, what cargo, how many people they could carry, all of those sorts of very practical aspects. And beginning with Dampier, navigators were astonished by the sophistication of indigenous boats, and they were all the more astonished because people in the Pacific didn't have iron tools. So all of these sailing canoes, often large double-hulled or outrigger canoes, were made completely with stone or shell tools, and the Europeans considered them extraordinarily accomplished, effective boats. Dampier said the Chamorro canoes, the canoes from Guam, were perhaps the finest of any boats in the world. Cook similarly was full of admiration for the sailing capacities of Polynesian canoes. He'd say they are capable of distant navigation, and by that he meant they could sail not just between islands that were within sight of each other, but between archipelagos. They could undertake voyages of hundreds or thousands of miles.
At the same time, they're observing the technology. They're observing common words or similar words, philology, across in these voyages. And you mention other voices, other scholars over this period of time, a Frenchman, D'Urville, and others who have noticed the philological similarity across this vast landscape, suggesting again there was commerce or traveling or voyaging for foundation. All those things are possible. At the same time, the Europeans are imposing their understanding of hierarchy. And it's a treat to see, Professor, how the fashion comes in and out of trying to discern Oceania and its richness. It isn't until we have a book in 1938 from a Maori, Rangi Hiroa, Vikings of the Sunrise, that all this comes together. Do I say correctly that it isn't until the 20th century we come to an understanding of what we're looking at?
Well, one of the remarkable aspects of Cook's voyages is that, especially when he gets to Easter Island, when he gets to Rapa Nui, he immediately recognizes that the people are speaking related languages, and also that they're tattooed, for example, in ways that are not identical to, but related to, say, the tattooing of Maori and Tahitians. And he was astonished by this unmistakable evidence for the relatedness of all of these people. So that relatedness meant that they had somehow started from somewhere, and he correctly intuited that that must have been to the west, to Asia. And he was essentially correct in understanding that people started in Asia and then settled this extraordinary range of islands, and that was almost unbelievable. Understandings did evolve, and I think the key achievement in the 20th century, Rangi Hiroa told the story from the perspective of Maori. It ceased to be a story about other people. It was a story about the achievements of his own people. But what followed that was most critical was the development of radiocarbon dating, and then the beginnings of what we think of as modern scientific archaeology. So it wasn't just that connections were being made on the basis of words or other cultural affinities, but that precise dating of archaeological sites made it possible to begin to tell the story in a much more precise way, in the same kind of precise way that archaeologists had understood the history of the Mediterranean, for example.
A detail here that I smiled and I laughed when I came across it, Professor. Johann Reinhold Forster was on board Resolution for the second Cook voyage. His son, Georg Forster, a very young man, later travels with Alexander von Humboldt. So what we're looking at here is a connection between discovering the Pacific and discovering the Americas. Von Humboldt leads the revelation of nature in Europe. So there's, I know it's too fantastic to credit the South Pacific with all of this, but it is wonderful to see how the same information is turned over and over to come to revelations in other parts of the world that are unknown.
Well, I think, in fact, the Cook voyages were extraordinarily inspiring to generations of scientists in that period, and the Forsters themselves were particularly imaginative writers who wrote very beautifully about the island environments, the distinctiveness of landscape and foliage and tropical light and water and all of these sorts of subjects. And in fact, George Forster was himself an extremely accomplished romantic writer, and his book did have a great influence on Humboldt, among many others. Certainly they were works that promoted a kind of fascination with natural history and the world that was at that time still known to a very partial extent by European scientists.
I want to be keen on one detail. I went too fast over it. The Dutch, in April of 1616, fired on a double-hulled canoe bearing 25 people, and at the same time marveled at the construction of that. That's early, 17th century. Did that information get isolated and not distributed through Europe? Is that why they're always rediscovering the same revelations?
That's right. I mean, information was unsystematically published early on. It was not that it was not published, and that narrative which first appeared in the Netherlands in the early 17th century was translated and republished, so that British explorers were aware of that information, but often the information was vague regarding place and exactly who those people were and where they were when they were encountered and so on. Something changes at the time of Cook's voyages. People begin to develop a deeper familiarity because those voyages ranged so widely. But importantly also, Pacific Islanders themselves began to know Europeans and know who they were dealing with and interact in deeper ways with Europeans. And that meant that the deep knowledge they themselves had of the ocean, of navigation, of trade, of traditional history, islanders began to share that knowledge with Europeans. And that's what brings us back to John Williams and others in the mid-19th century, who were really learning a great deal from local people who were intimately aware of the ocean, the ways of navigating it, the qualities of that environment.
Now a mystery, when we come back. A not quite a map, an archive from Cook's voyages, thanks to a Society Islander, Tupaya, who died too quickly in Batavia of disease on that voyage. But his map, not quite a map, remains a challenge for everybody to understand how this vast landscape was navigated. Professor Nicholas Thomas, the book is Voyagers, the Settlement of the Pacific. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.